This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's a fine time for bad news bears. World floods continue, this time in Asia. The Arctic has an ozone hole. Oh yeah, and the global financial system is on the edge of bankruptcy. Our first guest says people who care about the environment need to pay attention to the ongoing mega bailouts in Europe, maybe coming back to America soon. Those last financial resources, the billions and trillions that could have funded conversion to safe energy, are swirling down the drain. We are passing the toxic banking mess to our children. Let them pay. After a quick trip to Europe, we'll pull back to a shocking revelation from science. Alder Stone Fuller teaches us about Type 2 climate change, the fast, violent kind, which can shake civilization down in less than a decade. This is not a movie or crank disaster porn. Don't miss our extended interview with Alder Stone Fuller, complete with readings from The End of the Long Summer with author Diane Dumanoski.
The hard truth is that there are no solutions that can simply halt this planetary emergency, stop the dramatic changes that are already underway, and save the world we have known.
In just a moment, you'll hear from the Automatic Earth.
Organizers of the Occupy Wall Street protest are angry at government bank bailouts.
Scuffles in New York between the police and demonstrators calling themselves Occupy Wall Street appeared on YouTube as activists tweeted that dozens of people had been arrested. The group is using social media to call for peaceful protests against what they describe as corporate greed in America. Occupy Wall Street organizers say they intend to continue their so-called occupation for change indefinitely.
This is Radio EcoShock.
There's no way to avoid the ongoing disaster in world banking circles. Our next guest says we should pay attention because politicians and bankers are selling off our future. We may have no money to pay for mass transit, solar conversion, or any project to save ourselves from peak oil or climate change. Are we entering a new feudal age where 99% of us are debt slaves? We'll go now to a man whose blog rings true for millions of people. Writing as Ilargi, our guest dives into the latest banking fantasies, looking for reality. From the Automatic Earth, Ilargi, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to be here.
I wanted our listeners to hear you, Ilargi, because even though you're a financial writer and Radio EcoShock is mainly environmental, you wrote that people concerned with the environment should watch these financial bailouts carefully. Why do you say that?
Specifically because I think that maybe people who focus on the environment right now are missing out on the financial crisis, which is much more urgent, which is a much shorter time frame. And by missing out on that, they risk getting us into a situation where their children, for whom they wish to preserve the environment, will have no choice but to destroy it, because they will have nothing left. You can imagine a situation in which people burn every last tree simply because they're cold. We tend to think more from a situation of luxury.
And you don't think that luxury is going to continue?
Not the way we're going now.
Well, getting to that trigger point for the European crisis that everybody writes about, we know that Greece entered the European Union fraudulently. Goldman Sachs helped Greece to hide those mountains of debt in some shadow banking system. Do you think that Goldman Sachs undermined the European Union?
In that sense, yeah. I would rather put it in more broad strokes, though. I don't think that focusing too much on Greece is all that healthy. Because Greece is not the problem, and Greece is the first part of the problem that shows up. What I read a lot these days, ever since the Greek crisis really started being prominent, is that if only we would do that, or if only we would do that, and it's the fault of the politicians who don't take the right measures. And you have a lot of that kind of comment, and I think it's all bogus. I think the entire situation is completely, there's no solution for it.
Well, I'm reading that in your blog. You seem to be getting sort of fed up and almost wishing the whole thing would blow up. It might be better for us. Is that how you feel?
Well, That sounds very negative, Alex. I think, and I've written this repeatedly, what has to happen is all the assets held in bank vaults have to be marked to market. There's far too much stuff in bank vaults that nobody has put any valuation on. And so there's a lot of stuff that's in their vaults for 100 cents on the dollar and it's only worth 10 cents on the dollar. And it's time that we recognize the real financial situation of the banks. Because, you know, what a lot of the politicians say these days with all this bailout money is that it's to restore the confidence in the market. But how are you going to restore confidence in the market if the markets know that there's still a lot of paper, trillions of dollars worth of paper in bank vaults that everybody refused to put, let's say, a true valuation on?
What if these banks actually come clean and it turns out they're totally bankrupt? Then what do we do?
Then they have to go bankrupt.
But our money's in there.
And what we should do as societies is ring fence is a popular word, ring fence the deposits of the people rather than saving the banks. The story we are fed is not true. You know, the story we are fed is that we have to save the banks because that's the way we will save ourselves. But if the banks are too deep in debt, that's not going to work, is it?
And the same goes for countries.
The idea is that if $1 trillion of public money doesn't work, make it five, and that should work. But so far we haven't proven that, have we? So maybe it's time for a different tack.
What sort of tactic? Well, you said. You.
Well, exactly. Marking all the debt to market, and whoever is too deep in debt will have to be restructured and default and maybe go bankrupt.
My problem with that is, you know, I've got a little bit of a pension, and I know that that's somewhere in this banking system, and I hope my bank account will open next week. So if these banks go bankrupt, it could go global, and what happens to my pension?
Well, yeah, but why would you presume that the present bailout rump would save your pension?
Well, that's a question I don't have an answer for.
No, I think that will be typical of a lot of people. We are fed the idea that there is a solution to this. You know, there must be a solution to this, but maybe there's not. I mean, pension plans are Ponzi schemes, you know, they're pyramid schemes, in the sense that you will always need fresh input, and the fresh input will always have to be bigger than the older input. That's the pyramid model.
But that can't happen because, in fact, in many of the Western countries, there are fewer younger people working compared to the baby boomers who are expecting to collect the pensions.
This is where we say bingo.
Well, you know, here in North America, this is being covered as a European banking crisis.
Yeah, they like that.
There are a lot of connections and risks for Americans. Can you talk about that?
The fact that the Americans like so much to talk about this as a European issue is, first of all, to take attention away from their own problems. I mean, I was just reading an article today, I think it was in The Guardian, about underwater mortgages in the States. Well, who's talking about underwater mortgages these days? Not a lot of people, because everybody likes to talk about Greece, right? I think the U.S. itself is in very, very deep shit. And maybe Greece is a little bit worse, but it can't be that much. And plus, Greece is a lot smaller than the U.S. But there's also a lot of banking connections. Morgan Stanley came under fire at the end of last week, and that is primarily because it has a lot of ties to French banks, which have a lot of ties to Greek banks, which have a lot of ties to the Greek government, because the Greek banks and the French banks all own a lot of Greek sovereign debt. And then Morgan Stanley has a lot of links to the French banks. And one thing that is hardly mentioned these days is derivatives. And apparently Morgan Stanley still has a $56 trillion derivative portfolio, if I remember well. And of course, Morgan Stanley is very closely connected to all the other banks on Wall Street. And it's a simple story, really.
And you're in Europe now, are you?
I'm now in Europe, yeah.
And there seems to be news coming out every day about another failure. Denmark just put $72 billion into their banks to keep them from bankruptcy. And then we have the Dexia failure right next door to you there in Belgium.
Yeah. Those are two relatively new stories. I don't really know that much about Denmark because they haven't been in the news at all. One of the things I mentioned to Tony, my co-editor, is that we never hear about the Danish krona as a safe haven currency, you know? Which is something you do hear about a Canadian dollar or the Norwegian in general terms. But Denmark has been uncharted territory a bit so far.
Well, they don't have the oil that the Norwegians have. The Norwegians have saved up this gigantic investment fund, so they sound like a safer bet, I'll grant you. But Dexia is the largest lender to local governments in Belgium, and it's borrowed more than any other bank from the U.S. Federal Reserve System. At one point, they had $31 billion from the U.S.
58 at one point.
They've had two rescues already, and now the talk is they may have to be nationalized. Well, that just means passing the losses on to the taxpayers.
But it's more complicated because Dexia is the largest lender to French municipalities, you know, and France is a lot bigger country than Belgium. I think the origin of Dexia is Belgian, but it's now half French, half Belgian, and they're talking about a joint bailout as well. Both the Belgian government and the French government are working on a bailout plan. The problem now for this, and you read that in the next bailout schemes being concocted for Europe as well, you know, if the stability mechanism would be leveraged to $2 trillion from the present $220 or $440 billion, whichever number you take, then Standard & Poor's has already said that they're going to take a very close look at the credit rating of both Germany and France. And if France, with the shaky banks that they have, like Société Générale lost God knows how much money in the past few months, market capitalization, like 60 or 70% or something in just a few months' time. And that, of course, has a lot to do with the French government. Now, if France would also bail out Dexia, then Standard & Poor's may look very closely at the French credit rating anyway,
you know? You know, Ilargi, and we are talking with Ilargi, and his blog with Stone Lay at theautomaticearth.com is one of the most popular financial blogs on the net.
It's still .blogspot.com. It'll soon be .com.
Okay, .blogspot.com.
Right.
I wanted to say, many of us admire Europeans for their pleasant standard of living, their health care, their vacation time, and now that seems to be all going down the drain. It's darkening prospects around the world. Is this European dream over?
To a large part, I would think so, yeah. The dream part of it certainly is, yeah. If you define the dream as the Greeks and the Portuguese having the same standard of living as the Dutch and the Germans, because that is sort of what the Eurozone dream, at least, was about, yeah. I think the underlying dream, if you look at the European Union, was more for Germany and Holland to gain export markets. You know, so the idea was first to pour a lot of money into the periphery, the poorer countries in Southern Europe, and then have these people buy all your products.
Well, they poured the money in, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, but you can read a lot of analyses that are largely true, saying that Germany has profited more from the European Union than any other country because they sell so much more to other European countries now. So the export dream has come true to an extent, but is as you say, is ending now.
What are you hearing as you travel in Europe?
A lot of denial. We just left France and came to Holland last night, and I saw one news ticker that said there was an economics professor here in Holland who said that Holland's on the verge of an enormous housing crisis. Because home prices really haven't come down here yet. And that's amazing. I mean, it's a very overpopulated country. But still, you know, it's not about home values or how many people want homes. In the end, it's all about a credit crunch. And if there's no credit, then nobody is going to buy a home.
Well, let's say there is a major collapse. Some French banks close, government services are slashed, and we get minimum services. It could happen here in North America. It is happening here in North America. What happens to us common people on the ground?
In France, it means that tractors are going to drive their way into the Champs-Élysées in Paris, because that's what always happens in France, right? I mean, they know one thing, it's how to protest. In the U.S., you have the Occupy Wall Street movement now. Yeah, I think that's inevitable all over the world. I mean, I would never propagate revolution, but yeah, I mean, if you squeeze people hard enough, then they're going to say, ow, that hurts. Stop that.
Yeah, there are protests happening around North America. They're not big yet, but they could be the start of something big. People are angry about banking fraud and the way government seems to be sold out.
Well, you know, it's What I read about the Occupy Wall Street movement is, and I sympathize in general with them, is I have to wonder what these people know, what their level of knowledge is about it. I mean, to say that it's all banking fraud or it's the fault of the banks. Look, the banks can only do what politicians allow them to do. In general, I think what you have in Europe, what you have in North America, is if you allow money to enter politics, then money will buy politics, will buy the political system. And it's very hard to get it out again.
Well, one of the things I enjoy about your writing at theautomaticearth.blogspot.com, you poke pins in the balloons floated by these big financial players. I mean, these bailout funds that can be suddenly multiplied by trillions of euros or dollars, they just hit a computer key. How can we comprehend sort of fantasy money at the top like that?
What we can comprehend is that this crisis we're in, the financial part of it, not the political part of it, that's a different chapter, but the financial part of it is a debt crisis. Like, I think a lot of people can understand that. Like from individuals to governments to companies, certainly banks, everybody has borrowed too much. Everybody has too much debt. And then if you read about the European bailout fund, that there was a plan that apparently came from Tim Geithner, which was sort of funny, which basically suggests that they put 1.6 trillion euros in pure debt in this thing just by leveraging it. And like, leverage is how we got here. How can it be the way out then? Can you really solve too much debt with more debt?
Well, if my Visa card is overloaded, I can just go get another Visa card and borrow some more and pay it back with that. That should work.
Right. You think so? Oh, I think that ends somewhere. I think maybe we're at that point, or just about. Both the politicians and the industrial leaders, I always or often put brackets between leaders, or quotation marks, not brackets, quotation marks. And a lot of the industrial leaders, banking leaders, political leaders, owe their positions to the status quo, to the system that we have now. So they'll do anything to try and save that system. And you voted them in and thereby gave them unlimited access to your money. So they can take your money from here to Christmas and keep on spending it, trillion after trillion after trillion, and then they start in your kids' money and your grandkids' money. I think it has to stop somewhere.
Is there a financial reality with real wealth? What would that look like?
Real wealth? Well, there's 1% of the American population that seems to have real wealth. I think the other 99% really has to wonder and worry about their wealth.
Ilargi, is there anything you'd like to add or leave with our listeners as we wrap up?
I don't know. I was just getting started, but so let's do another one soon then, Alex.
Okay, we'll do that. I know we can have a good long conversation. Right now you're traveling. It's not such a good time, but let's get back again.
We will. That's good.
Our guest has been the financial blogger Ilargi, a constant contributor to the blog The Automatic Earth. A new entry comes out several times a week. I read them all. You should too. Ilargi, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
The door to the comfortable and familiar world we depend on has already slammed shut behind us. It is already too late to prevent global warming or to solve the climate crisis. Too late to prevent powerful forces from altering the trajectory of human history. That we have already crossed some ominous thresholds, however, does not mean that it is too late to do anything at all. We humans are at a critical juncture, an historical moment that requires courage and sober realism. We cannot bank on the end of the world or deliverance from the trials of existence, whether through biblical apocalypse or our own extinction, nor can we proceed on blind faith in technological salvation. Fear, despair, and denial are indulgences we cannot afford. It is time to turn and face the future head on.
That was a reading from The End of the Long Summer, Why We Must Remake Our Civilization to Survive on a Volatile Earth by the author Diane Dumanoski. With record floods, droughts, and fires all over the world, you are allowed to ask, has the climate already tipped? If not, We are certainly seeing what a major climate shift could look like. We're going to talk about a sudden, even violent shift of climate here on planet Earth. Could it happen, and what could we do? Alderstone Fuller has 4 degrees, starting with biology, probability theory and statistics, and finally his doctorate in ecology and biological evolution. He is qualified to teach in universities, but Alder prefers smaller institutions, including the Euglena Academy in Eugene, Oregon, during the early 2000s. He's just moved himself and his seminars to northern New England. Alder teaches, writes, hikes, and he dances a bit while developing his theories of a whole and living world called Gaia. Alder Stone, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. A pleasure to be here.
I spent 20 years trying to stop climate change. You say it's too late for that. That's a big subject that we will return to, but can you briefly tell us why do you think it's too late?
Well, first, I apologize for the bad news, and second, I want to make it clear that these really aren't my theories. I'm not developing these. I'm actually working more with the ideas that are being put forth by the people that I think are Earth's best climate scientists. At the top of the list for me is Dr. James Lovelock of Britain. I study and teach his ideas quite extensively. In terms of why we probably, always put that word probably in because of my background in probability theory, because we probably cannot stop climate change at this point, large-scale climate change, for a number of reasons. One, something called CO2 residence time. The excess CO2 that's in the atmosphere now will not drop out immediately, even if we completely stop producing greenhouse emissions tomorrow. If we go to zero emissions tomorrow, what's up there now is still going to be up there 100 years from now or longer. That's one. I can talk more extensively about that. Two, there are already at least 8 major global-scale positive feedback processes that are kicking in, and positive feedbacks, unlike negative feedbacks, positive feedbacks accelerate trends. So since we're already heating, positive feedback will heat us faster. And I can talk, if you wish, more about those 8 positive feedback processes. And then there's a couple of other phenomena. For example, just like a car going 70 miles per hour on an interstate can't be stopped on a dime, the climate system can't be stopped on a dime. It's got an inertia to it. So even if we stop producing greenhouse gases tomorrow, we're still going to continue to heat for a while. And there's also, fourth, there's a phenomenon called global dimming. It's caused by aerosol pollution in the upper atmosphere. Most of that is sulfur dioxide being produced by burning fossil fuels, dirty fossil fuels. Aerosols produce clouds, and that tends to artificially cool us. So in reality, we are probably 1 to 3 degrees centigrade warmer than we think we are because those clouds are up there cooling us artificially. And if we stop burning fossil fuels tomorrow, those sulfur dioxides will drop out of the atmosphere very quickly, a matter of weeks, weeks to months, and we'll heat immediately, at least as much as we heat in the entire 20th century. So if you put all those together, it's a logical argument that we probably can't stop large-scale change at this point. We should try. We'd be foolish not to try. We should pull out the stops, but we probably can't stop it.
Well, listeners, we've run into something more than a man with a theory. This is deep science and deep ecology, and it's going to take some digging. Alder, let us introduce your program with a kind of table of contents. Could you give us a brief outline of the 4 steps in your approach, the type 2 change, the emotions, and the adaptability, and the new science? So what are you going for there?
Good question, Alex. I think the place to start, well, the place that I start, at least in my program to try to help communities understand this, people in communities understand it, is step number one probably is to help people understand the distinction between type 1 climate change and type 2 climate change. And 1 and 2 here is usually written with a Roman numeral. Type 1 climate change is mostly what you're hearing in mainstream media, coming from the body called IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that UN-mandated and funded group, who's done a wonderful job over the last 20 years or so, starting in the early 1990s, of assessing the current state of climate science. There's 1,500 or so renowned climate scientists from around the world, from virtually every nation, and their job is about every 5 years to evaluate the published studies about climate and try to see where we are now with the climate question and make projections for the century. And they do a good job. They're knowledgeable people, but they're hamstrung by the political process. Every government in the world, rather, has line item veto on anything that they don't like. And so even though the climate scientists understand more than they're putting forth, the politicos don't like that, and so they restrict what the reports say. As a result, add to that the fact that IPCC models are missing most of those positive feedbacks. That's a whole story in itself. So their projections tend to look like an elevator ride, a slow, gradual heating through this century, so that by 2100 we may be somewhere between 4 and 8 degrees centigrade warmer than now. And that's type 1 climate change, smooth, gradual, predictable. What we know from unequivocal data, both empirical data, mainly from the ice core studies, and from theoretical results, much of what I teach that I'll talk about next, climate change normally is not type 1. It's not gradual and smooth. It's very rapid and abrupt. It may be smooth for a while. It has been for the last 10,000 years, abnormally so. We don't know why the last 10,000 years have been so smooth and stable. But during ice ages, climate can change as much in a single decade as it has in the last 10,000 years, and that's more typical, really rapid, large, extreme changes. That's type 2. So whereas the IPCC is projecting type 1, what we're really looking at is type 2.
Hold on. Let's stop there, because I think that is really so important. And I want our listeners to know that this idea of rapid climate change is not fringe science. And in January 2010, I interviewed Dr. Michael McCracken. He's one of America's leading scientists. He was a principal author of a collection of papers called Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change. We've talked to Dr. Bob Spicer of Open University in UK, who's described these previous greenhouse worlds for us and how fast they can change. We've all seen, Alder, these graphs of the IPCC, and they just go slowly up to 2100. And you're saying, no, we could have a big jump, and it could be starting right now, or it could be starting in 2020. Is that it?
That is correct. And what more to the point, I guess, what I'm saying, and this is what James Lovelock and others are saying as well, the jump has already started. We're on the bottom end of a really rapid upswing. And the biggest jump, Lovelock believes, because of a model that he and geophysicist Lee Kump produced and published in Nature, Journal Nature, in 1994, I think it was. No, 1992. They predict an 8 degree centigrade jump somewhere between now and 2050, mid-century or so. Now, that's 8 degrees total. It's on top of what we've already increased. So we've already increased 1 degree. Think about the next couple of decades or so, another couple of degrees centigrade, and then a big pop from there up to a total of 8 degrees centigrade. Is that going to happen? Nobody knows, but the evidence, both empirical and theoretical, behind it is very strong, and we'd be foolish not to take these ideas into account.
Well, we're going to continue with Alder Fuller in just a minute. We've kind of run out of time for this session. Check out alderstone3.com. In our next interview with Alder, you will hear his suggestions more about what we can do, some real-world tips to prepare, and then how to boost your knowledge of the big picture. We really need to go back to school, all of us, with this new science and to understand what Gaia science is about. Thank you so much, Alder, and let's continue our discussion.
You're welcome, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith. Stay tuned for Alder Fuller, Part 2, on Radio EcoShock.